Hello, and welcome to the Clinical Care Options Infectious Disease Podcast. I'm your host, Jennifer Swanson. Clinical Care Options was the official conference coverage partner of the IAS 11th Conference on HIV Science 2021. Today's episode features content from an educational webinar titled, Key Studies Influencing My Practice Following IAS 2021. During this podcast, Dr. Babafemi Taiwo, Chief of Infectious Diseases at Northwestern University's Feinberg School of Medicine, discusses new HIV data from the WHO Global Clinical Platform and the TANGO, FLAIR, CALIBRATE, CAPELLA, Protocol 11, Protocol 16, and XENIX trials. For more information on Dr. Taiwo and a link to the full online educational program, including downloadable slides, please visit the show notes for this episode. Now let's get started and hear what Dr. Taiwo has to say about new HIV data from IAS 2021.
Yeah, thank you very much. And welcome again to the audience. So here's a program overview. We'll talk briefly about COVID-19 in the context of HIV. Then we'll deal with a few of the treatment paradigms that we are getting more familiar with. And then we'll address the TB case or situation. So let's start with the COVID-19 presentation, which really advances our understanding of how COVID-19 can affect persons living with HIV infection. And this study really came from data collected by the WHO through its global clinical platform, ending in about April of this year. The data came from multiple countries, so it's rather robust. 24 countries were involved, almost 170,000 patients. But most of the participants were actually from South Africa, about 95% came from South Africa. And the population that was included those who had HIV infection, which comprised almost 10%. And so it was possible to compare how persons living with HIV compared to those who did not have HIV infection. And be mindful that this is really focused on persons who were admitted with COVID-19. And there were two key questions on the table. One was, amongst those who were admitted with COVID-19, how did having HIV infection impact the disease severity at the time of admission in terms of the severity or critical nature of it? And also, amongst those who were admitted, how did being HIV infected affect mortality? Did it increase it? Did it not have any effect? Or did it decrease it? So these were the key questions. The findings, in a nutshell, were number one, that HIV infection independently was associated with an increased risk of severe or critical COVID-19 at the time of admission, and also associated with an increase in the risk of mortality. And if you think about the patients who were or participants in this study, those who had HIV infection really did not know too much about their baseline CD4 count, viral load, treatment history, et cetera. But they did comprise a very large population. And as I said before, many were from South Africa. So it made sense to do a sensitivity analysis, excluding those who came from South Africa to make sure that the results were robust. And in fact, when that was done, the findings were consistent. And in terms of proportion, there was about a 13% increased likelihood of being admitted with severe or critical disease if you are HIV infected, and also about a 30% increase in hospital mortality if you were HIV infected compared with those who did not have HIV infection. And focusing on those who had HIV infection, the factors that were associated with increased risk were further identified as age greater than 65, being male, being diabetic, being hypertensive, and the same risk factors were also seen, focusing on those who have HIV as factors that increase their risk of mortality. And these factors actually track quite closely what we know already from the general population. So the take-home message is that amongst those who have HIV infection, it does confer increased risk of coming in with a severe disease if you're admitted, with about 30% increased risk and about 30% increased risk of mortality when admitted. So let's move quickly to another study, the TANGO study, which we've been hearing a lot about over the last few years. Just to refresh your memory, the TANGO looked at participants who were on 3 or 4 drug tablet regimen who were suppressed and were subsequently randomized to continuation of their three or four drug TAF-based regimen versus switching to dolutegravir 3TC. We've heard results from the week 48 endpoint, which was the primary endpoint, and also results from the week 96, both of which showed that there was non-inferiority in maintenance of biologic suppression amongst those who took the, who continued three or four drug TAF-based regimen versus those who switched to dolutegravir 3TC. And so this is a post-hoc analysis that looked at viral replication and inflammatory biomarkers at week 96. This is a deep dive look at the data. And in order to get more, a deeper look at the virologic outcomes, what was done in this study was to look at, use a different assay, the Abbott assay, which allows you to not only check for viral RNA less than 40 copies per mil, but also to determine if you're able to detect the viral target at levels less than 40 copies per mil. So this is a very deep look at the presence of virus and how much virus could be present. And of course, in this particular study, success was defined using very stringent definition. Specifically, you were successful if you had both viral load less than 40 copies per mil and you had no target for HIV detected. So this is a very stringent criteria that was used for defining virologic success. And using those, you'll see in the figure that there was really no difference that's significant between those who switched to dolutegravir 3TC versus continuation of free drug regimen. Biologic failure there comprises those who had anything other than biologic success. So even if you had a viral load of 43, in this study you were considered a biologic failure, but that's why the numbers might seem high, but it does compare very well with, you know, between the two groups. So the bottom line here is that this study showed that using very sensitive assays, using a very sensitive assay, there really was no significant difference in biologic outcomes. This is consistent with what we already knew before when the study was, when looking at confirmed biologic withdrawal, in which case we have had zero participants in the dolutegravir 3TC arm experiencing biologic withdrawal, which in this case was defined as having two consecutive RNA over 50 copies per mil. And this, whereas there have been about three persons with confirmed biologic withdrawal in the TAF-based arm. Another question that we've always asked is the risk of resistance. And of course, there's been no resistance at all in this study so far amongst all the participants. And there were a handful of patients, seven participants, who had archived mutations at the time of entry into the study. This was determined retrospectively, but this has not affected their biologic outcomes. They remain suppressed. So very strong data for dolutegravir 3TC looking at very stringent markers of replication and looking at inflammatory markers, because there have been questions about whether the presence of use of two drugs will increase inflammation. And in this case, at week 96, there was really no significant difference between those who continued dolutegravir plus 3TC versus those who switched to TAF-based ART. There were small and comparable changes in inflammatory markers in this study. And the final set of outcomes that were evaluated were metabolic outcomes. And what you need to remember from this is that changes in fasting lipids in this study actually favored dolutegravir plus 3TC. And if you look at the table, you'll see that all the specific markers of lipids, so triglycerides, HDL, LDL, and total cholesterol HDL ratio, all of them decreased amongst those who were on dolutegravir 3TC. And they increased amongst those who continued their three-drug ART-based regimen. So this was the only metabolic marker that differed between the groups, and it favored dolutegravir 3TC. All the other metabolic parameters that were looked at did not exhibit any significant difference between the groups. So there was no difference in weight that was significant, no difference when looking at baseline glucose, no difference when looking at insulin resistance, no difference when looking at metabolic syndrome. Only lipid changes favored dolutegravir 3TC. And this was the only metabolic finding. And so we go back to the question that you were first asked at the beginning of the session, which is the week 144 analysis of TANGO non-inferiority study of switching to dolutegravir 3TC versus continuing to three or more TAF-based ART showed which of the following metabolic outcomes when compared with baseline? Is it A, changes in glucose and insulin resistance favored dolutegravir 3TC, or B, changes in fasting lipids favored dolutegravir 3TC, or is it C, the proportion of participants with metabolic syndrome was greater in the dolutegravir 3TC arm, or was it D, weight gain was significantly greater in TAF-based ART, or are you unsure? So please go ahead and pick the right answer. Okay, so the correct answer is number two. So we move on to the next question, topic, which is FLAIR week 124 results. Again, reminding you about FLAIR. FLAIR is a study that is looking at long-acting cabotegravir plus rilpivirine. In this study, participants were first given three drug therapy until they achieved suppression. And following suppression, they either continued their three drug therapy or they were switched to cabotegravir or rilpivirine at long acting. We already have data looking at week 48. We have data looking at week 96 showing non-inferiority in terms of biologic outcomes. But now we have data looking at week 124. So looking much longer. And here we have a slide that compares the findings from week 96 to week 124. And essentially, over this period, there have been five additional participants who had a virologic RNA greater than or equal to 50 copies per mil. And of course, there was one participant who had confirmed virologic failure, which in this study was defined as having two consecutive HIV RNA greater than 200 copies per mil. These were the two most important findings from a biologic standpoint. And looking at safety and tolerability, you will see from this slide that the results at week 124 were consistent with data found from the earlier analysis in terms of looking at any serious adverse events being about 12% in participants who were on the long-acting regimen, and essentially having only two additional new cases between week 96 and week 124. Looking at drug-related serious AEs, essentially no new cases, which is really where you want to focus the attention when looking at adverse events and trying to attribute them to the intervention or not. In this case, I would say look at the drug-related serious AEs, which overall through week 124 is just one, and new since week 96 is zero. So really testifying to the very good tolerability of the regimen. Of course, what continues to be the main reported AE is are injection site reactions. And consistent with what we knew before, the injection site reactions typically manifest as pain, sometimes as nodule, sometimes with induration. They tend to be of a short duration, still at about 3 days. Withdrawal due to this continues to be uncommon, total of 7 to 8, about 2% overall. So again, showing that this is overall well-tolerated regimen. And going back to the virologic results, in which we had one new participant who developed confirmed virologic failure out of the five that have viral load greater than 50 between week 96 and week 24. There's more granular data presented here by that participant, male participant. BMI, interestingly, was less than 30, which is a cutoff that we've somewhat associated when combined with other risk factors as possibly increasing the risk of virologic failure in so those who have at least one of the other two baseline risk factors for virologic failure. So this participant, when thinking about the three baseline risk factors that have been identified, so one BMI, the second being HIV-1 subtype A6 or A1, and the third being baseline resistance-associated mutations, only one was really present in this patient, which was a subtype A6. And the patients actually developed some resistance mutations, not just in integrase, but also in the NNRTI class, which is consistent with what we've seen with many of the earlier biologic failures on this regimen. The drug levels were somewhat on the low side earlier on, and how much of an influence this had on outcomes is rather unclear at this point. Interestingly, the patients are resuppressed on the new regimen. Now let's move quickly to Capella. Capella is a study, or one of the studies looking at lenacapavir, which is a new capsid inhibitor, distinguished in the fact that it's administered subcutaneously and is now being looked at in treatment experienced patients and also those who are treatment naive. So Capella looked at lenacapavir in treatment experienced patients. So these were patients who were highly exposed to regimen, different regimens, highly drug resistant. 99% of them had NRTI resistance, 97 NNRTI resistance, 82 PI resistance, and many of them really, some of them did not have any drug options left. So we're going to be talking essentially about the randomized cohort. And the randomized cohort in this particular study were those who, after entry, upon repeat, their HIV RNA had dropped by at least 0.5 logs. And so these patients the initial HIV RNA had dropped by at least 0.5 logs were randomized 2-to-1 to either taking lenacapavir orally initially versus placebo. And this initial part of the study called functional monotherapy, we already have data from that, just testing whether lenacapavir in this highly resistant population would have an effect. And in fact, we know from the previously presented data that the primary endpoint of at least 0.5 log reduction in viral load was achieved when lenacapavir alone was used in this context. And so what we are looking at now is follow-up of that, in which these participants have now been transitioned to subcutaneous lenacapavir given every 6 months compared with optimized background regimen. And we are looking at week 26 data, which means data 20 after being on the subcutaneously administered lenacapavir plus an optimized background regimen for about 24 weeks. And what we see here is quite impressive, in that number one, looking at viral load suppression less than 50, in this highly resistant population, 81% of the participants who were viremic and failing the treatment were able to achieve viral suppression. And this high rate of viral suppression less than 50 was seen even amongst those who had no fully active agents in the optimized background regimen. You can see that 67% of the participants who had no active agent were able to achieve HIV RNA less than 50 copies per mil, and it goes up to 86% in some groups. Of course, in this kind of cohort, you would expect that some patients would have a viral load greater than 200, despite the new medication, because remember, they were highly experienced patients, highly treatment resistant in many cases. So it's not shocking that about 11% of the participants still had a viral load greater than 200 copies per mil at this week 26 look. So after being on treatment for about 24 weeks with subcutaneous lenacapavir and optimized background regimen. But the majority of the patients still had viral suppression less than 50 copies per mil, quite dramatic. In terms of CD4 count, participants did see improvement in their CD4 count, a mean change of about 81 cells per millimeter cubed. And the amount of proportion of patients who had CD4 count less than 50 actually decreased. So many patients whose CD4 count was less than 50 when they came into the study went above 50 copies per mil. So the proportion decreased from 22% at baseline to 0 at 26 weeks. In fact, all the patients who had CD4 counts less than 50 when they came to the study, they had the CD4 count go above 50 by week 26. So quite significant impact on CD4 count as well. In terms of safety, you can see here that there are several symptoms reported here. But again, remember that these are highly treatment experienced patients, advanced disease. It's very common to see a lot of reported symptoms, and which will be called AEs. The question is how many of these are attributable to the regimen per se. And I think those will be many of these symptoms reported here are due to other things, perhaps not the medication per se. But what we know is associated with the drug clearly are the injection site reactions, which can manifest as swelling, erythema, pain, nodule formation, or induration. But we also know that when they do occur, these injection site reactions tend to be of the lower grade, so they're not grade 4 in general. And one thing that tells us that patients may experience this, but they still want the treatment, is that all the 36 patients in the randomized cohort that received the initial injection continued to receive the second injection. So no one said, well, I had swelling, or I had erythema, or I had pain, or nodule, or induration. I don't want the next injection. All the participants who entered the randomized cohort continued the second injection, so showing that their treatment, acceptable treatment, did not change over that time period. And we also had, quite importantly, there was 4 participants who developed lenacapavir resistance during the study. 4 of them developed the M66I mutation, and 3 others developed additional mutations. Some of them were able to resuppress without changing regimen. But the message here is that lenacapavir can be associated in some patients with emergence of resistance, and this is something that we need to keep in mind. And so we go back to the question you answered earlier on, which is the week 26 results of the randomized double-blind arm of CAPELLA evaluating lenacapavir in heavily treatment-experienced persons with HIV showed, A majority of participants achieved HIV RNA less than 50 copies per mil, B, no participants had HIV RNA greater than or equal to 200 copies per mil, or is it C, the proportion of participants with very low CD4 count remained unchanged from baseline, or is it D, no emergent resistance was observed, or are you unsure? Please go ahead and pick the right answer. Okay, the right answer is A. So we move to the next topic, which again is still on lenacapavir, but we're looking at it now in the treatment-naive context. In the CALIBRATE study, these were treatment-naive patients who initially were given, who were randomized to 4 groups. And one group is pretty obvious. On the bottom is a big TAF FTC. We're all familiar with that regimen. That was sort of the control arm. Next to that is the lenacapavir plus TAF FTC oral regimen. So everybody is going to get in this arm the lenacapavir plus TAF FTC throughout the study. Groups 1 and 2 are a little different, because the idea here is to give the patients initially 3 drug therapy, including lenacapavir. Now, remember, this is now subcutaneously administered, and eventually transition them to a 2-drug regimen in which they'll get the injection plus either TAF or bictegravir. And what's interesting here is that we are still looking right now at the secondary endpoint of week 28. So at this time point, everybody in the study, in the groups 1 and 2, are on, everybody is receiving lenacapavir plus TAF FTC in groups 1 and 2. Everybody in group 3 is, of course, receiving the oral lenacapavir plus TAF FTC, and everybody in group 4 is receiving big TAF FTC. And this is different patient population, because they are treatment naive. And what did the study show? The study showed that, number one, the big TAF FTC group, 100% of the participants so far have achieved biologic suppression. This is week 28. And we see that about 92 to 94% are suppression in the other groups. I think a key point is that one of the participants who did not achieve biologic suppression in the study from group 2 developed new resistance mutations at week 10. And so this is something that we'll have to keep in mind. It does show that lenacapavir patients can develop resistance early to it, and it's something that we have to follow as we learn more about it. But overall, a suppression was seen in a high proportion of patients, over 90% in general. Looking at adverse events in the study, of course, again, this injection site reactions are shown here. We see again that they tend to resolve quickly, most of the time resolving in days. Discontinuations were uncommon, were seen in two participants in this particular study. And overall, lenacapavir was well tolerated with a favorable safety profile, and there were no grade 3 or 4. There were no SAEs or grade 4 adverse events that were related to study drugs. Most of the most common AEs were headache and nausea. And another study, look now at islatravir plus doravirine, which is an important regimen because islatravir is a new nucleotide reverse transcriptase translocation inhibitor, which is under investigation both for treatment and also for prevention. This is a treatment study called Study 11 of Protocol 011, in which the goal is to see how it will work when used as two-drug therapy. And we've seen earlier results from this study in which starting with a three-drug dose ranging trial in which three different doses of islatravir were added to doravirine plus 3TC compared to doravirine 3TC TDF. And after 20 weeks, participants who were suppressed went on to part two, in which they were now reduced to two-drug regimen of the islatravir plus doravirine, and ultimately now that patients will continue in maintenance on islatravir at 0.75 milligrams plus doravirine as a two-drug regimen. But the question in this particular study was looking at safety through week 96. And here we see that there are no new drug-related AEs between week 48 and week 96. We continue to have a good safety report, nothing newly reported. The most common AEs in amongst those taking islatravir plus doravirine, I remember that now the patients are now on the two-drug regimen. They are on islatravir plus doravirine, having dropped the 3TC that they were on initially. The most common AEs were headache amongst those taking islatravir and doravirine, and diarrhea amongst those taking a three-drug regimen that does not include islatravir. Most events were mild, transient, not related to study treatment, and were similar at weeks 48 and 96. And looking at laboratory abnormalities, nothing again pops out. No dose-related trends are seen. There's nothing really that one can hang a hat on and say this is a sort of a signature laboratory abnormality. Several patients had elevated creatinine kinase, but that was attributed in those cases to increased exertion. So let's now turn to the use of oral islatravir once a month for PrEP, which is quite novel. Remember that all the therapies that we have for PrEP now had been oral, except some investigational long-acting agents. But this is looking at oral islatravir as a long-acting agent given once a month. And this study was interested in looking at the safety at week 24 and also the pharmacokinetic analysis. And study has some good attributes, a lot of female involved, 7% female. It was a geographically diverse study involving African and non-African settings, and looked at two doses of islatravir, 60 and 120 milligrams in comparison to placebo. And what we are looking at now are the data up to week 24 with the endpoints of safety and also the pharmacokinetics. Remember that islatravir, when taken orally, the active agent is the intracellular triphosphate. And so that is the level of interest when talking about drug levels. First, looking at the adverse events, most of the adverse events were mild. Discontinuations due to AEs were uncommon. There were two, and there was one participant that had, essentially, they were milder adverse events, and the regimen was well tolerated overall. And looking at grade 3 to 4 abnormalities in the laboratory data, these were rare and similar between islatravir and placebo groups. So they were really no cause for concern, thinking about laboratory abnormalities grade 3 or 4. They were rare and similar between both groups. Patient between both who took islatravir and those who did not take islatravir. Of course, there were 3 groups because there were 2 different doses of islatravir. And finally, looking at the drug concentrations intracellularly of the active triphosphate, which is really the goal. If you can see here, there are 2 figures shown here. The top one looking at islatravir 60 milligrams every month. The bottom one looking at islatravir 120 milligrams every month. And what you see is that the PK threshold that of interest or the target PK threshold for prevention is about 0.05 picomoles per 10 to the power 6 PBMC in PBMCs. And looking at 4 weeks after the first dose, you can see that the level of the intracellular agent in PBMCs was quite high, well above the threshold, the prevention threshold at 4 weeks after the first dose. And looking again at 4 weeks after the last dose, the 6th dose, you can see that the intracellular level of the active triphosphate was still very high, much higher than the target prevention threshold. And most importantly, 8 weeks after the last dose, you can see again that the intracellular level of the active triphosphate, which is what the prevention target, the level achieved with 120 milligrams or the 60 milligrams was were higher, significantly higher than the prevention threshold. So it didn't matter whether you were looking at it 4 weeks after the last dose or 8 weeks after the last dose, you still saw high levels of the intracellularly active drug, well above the target level for prevention. And this regimen, again, did not show any difference between the grade 3 or 4 abnormalities in those who got islatravir versus those who got placebo. And so we go back to the question that you saw earlier on, which is the week 24 safety and PK analysis of protocol 16. Evaluating monthly oral islatravir for PrEP showed that that mean intracellular concentration of islatravir triphosphate failed to achieve threshold for HIV prevention, or B, mean intracellular concentration of islatravir triphosphate remained above the threshold for less than 4 weeks after the last dose. Is it C, the mean intracellular concentration remained above the threshold for HIV prevention for at least 8 weeks after the last dose? Or is it D, grade 3 or 4 adverse events were more common with islatravir than placebo, or are you unsure? So please go ahead and vote. Okay, that's the correct answer. Is that the mean intracellular concentration remained above the threshold for prevention for at least 8 weeks after the last dose. And we go to the final topic, which is TB. And very quickly, we know that there are some patients who have highly drug-resistant TB. One of the regimens that's been used in this population includes 3 drugs, pretomanide, bedaquiline, and linezolid. But the challenge is that linezolid is associated with high rates of toxicity, hematologic toxicity, and neurotoxicity. So this drug was looking at a different dosing regimen in which linezolid will be administered at a lower dose and for shorter periods. And what was seen was that when you gave this 3-drug regimen, but in this case using different doses of linezolid, comparing the standard 1200 milligrams for 6 months, versus giving a shorter dose of the 1200 milligram dose, so 1200 milligrams daily, but for 2 months, and another risk strategy in which we'll use even a lower dose of linezolid, 600 milligrams for 6 months, or 600 milligrams for 2 months. What was seen here was that in terms of efficacy, you really did not lose anything significant from an efficacy standpoint in this group of patients with highly drug-resistant therapy. The results in this particular study called the Zenix study were consistent with high efficacy of the 3-drug regimen demonstrated in an earlier study called the NIX-TB. And all the favorable outcomes that were looked at are looking at culture-negative status at 6 months post-treatment, and time to culture negative status were similar in all the treatment arms, showing that reducing the dose of linezolid or the duration of linezolid did not significantly impact outcomes. What it did impact, however, was the safety, because lower dose and or shorter duration of linezolid appears to be associated with fewer adverse events and dose modifications than using the standard dose. And this is of importance because it provides a treatment option for patients who have the tuberculosis that are multi-drug resistant and may need this complex regimen. And so on that note, we'll transition to the question and answer session.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Taiwo, for that wonderful presentation. We have had several questions from our audience, and so I'll pose as many as we can in the time remaining. First question comes from Brian, and he says the WHO, WHO usually uses a cutoff of less than 40 copies per mL for suppression, wondering why less than 40 was used in this study. I think he probably meant less than 50. I'm guessing he was referring to the FLAIR study. Are you aware of why they chose to use viral suppression at less than 50 copies per mL?
In the FLAIR study? Well, less than 50 is actually used quite often in clinical trials. I think that would be the standard cutoff that is used, because most of the assays that are available actually do come at less than 50. The less than 40, the only time we talked about less than 40 in this study, in this presentation, was in the context of the Tango study, in which participants were looking now at more lower level of viral replication. So looking at viral load less than 40 and target not detected, which you can only obtain really with the Abbott assay. And the Abbott assay will tell you that, but the other assays will report the viral load but not target detection or non-detection. So in general, less than 50 is what's used, but occasionally less than 40 is used, as was done in this in the Tango study.
Okay, so perhaps that was his question, actually. Hard to tell from the way it was written. I wonder about another question that comes in about that is, what do you think is the clinical relevance of the studies that use target not detected?
Yeah, I think in the clinic, we really don't pay more than, we don't pay attention, not much. We don't pay attention to the target detection or non-detection. And the reason is that if you look at any particular patient over time, you will see target non-detected today and target non-detected tomorrow, and the translation is really quite unclear. So I think the clinical relevance is very low. But if you're thinking about the research standpoint, where there have been theories proposed that maybe there's this very, very, very low level of replication taking place in patients who are on two-drug therapy, and maybe this very low level of replication can lead to inflammation and over years and years hurt the patient. I think this is what this study was really trying to get at, to see, can we see, using some of the most sophisticated insights that we have, can we see any difference in low level, really, really, really low level viral activity? And they didn't see anything. And of course, that is consistent with the absence of any difference in the inflammatory biomarker endpoint as well between the two arms. So clinically, not much, not very relevant, because we don't look at it really. But when you look at it in the context of a study and linking it to the potential for inflammation, it becomes important. Take home message, there was no difference whether the patient was on dolutegravir 3TC or patients continued 3-drug or 4-drug TAF continuing ART.
Thank you for that. Also, another question about lenacapavir. It's phrased this way, would oral lenacapavir be useful? So maybe if you could opine on, you know, injectable versus oral lenacapavir and what you think its place in therapy might be if approved.
Right, so that's an interesting question, because if you remember the design of the CALIBRATE study, there are 4 groups. One of the groups is lenacapavir 50 milligrams daily, and that's what the participant will be on throughout the study in combination with TAF-FTC. So you can tell right there that there is an intention in looking at oral lenacapavir by itself. This contracts with the groups 1 and 2, which, if you recall, participants were going to receive lenacapavir as a subcutaneous injection in combination initially with TAF-FTC and then with injection with either TAF or with bictegravir are going forward as a two-drug strategy. So I think that there is potential for oral lenacapavir if that study that we just described now shows promise with that construct and other attributes are hold up. But remember that the injection, the subcutaneous injection, again, is a subcutaneous injection, but patients will typically receive an oral loading before that as well. So it appears that there may be some, it's still very early, but there are certainly been investigated.
Wonderful. Thank you for that, Dr. Taiwo. And then another question here from Michael. In your perusing of all of the new data at the conference, did you notice anything of interest on cure, HIV cure?
HIV cure, there was a presentation that looked at vorinostat combined with VRC07. The goal there was to perturb the reservoir. Remember, vorinostat was supposed to be one of those agents that maybe could activate the viral reservoir, and maybe that can lead us one step towards a cure. Bottom line, negative study, nothing significant happened.
Okay, well, thank you. That's very useful. Negative studies are important too. And finally, because we're just about out of time, I want to ask you one more question. Which of the studies did you find that at this conference are really going to be clinically?
Clinically, the two studies are at least one, the TANGO study, because it's showing us that the two drug regimen of dolutegravir 3TC compared to three or four drug type containing regimen, from a virologic standpoint, there's really no difference. If of course in the population that was studied, and it also taught us that if you're looking for someone, the clinician or patient was thinking about, well, what might be a benefit to stopping TAF or stopping some of the other drugs like the booster, et cetera. This study showed that we had a study that showed lipid improvements in patients who were switched to dolutegravir 3TC. And we also learned that some of the metabolic parameters that we thought could be improved by taking patients off TAF, such as insulin resistance, that did not pan out when upon long-term follow-up. We looked looking at glucose, that did not pan out. Looking at weight change, that there was no difference. Looking at metabolic syndrome, there was no difference, but there was difference in terms of cholesterol. And although that did not lead, there was no difference in the number of patients or proportion of patients that initiated lipid-containing therapy as a result of it. But it's something that numerically did show something favorable for dolutegravir 3TC, and I think that is something to consider. The other thing is the use of long-acting therapy, cabotegravir or lopinavir. We just know that there was a new patient who had this virologic failure with resistance. And the caution there is that we just should select our patients, be mindful of the data, and this certainly is something that's available that will benefit many, many patients. But as providers, we have to think about the right patient for this strategy.
Well, thank you so much for that, Dr. Taiwo. And I said that was going to be the last question, but you brought up something that is frequently asked about, and that is selecting that right patient for the cabotegravir long-acting. So in your opinion, what would be the good candidate?
I think a good candidate, of course, number one, is someone who's been suppressed and patient has no evidence or concern, no known or concerned resistance against integrase inhibitor or NNRTI. And I think we already have information about three baseline risk factors that can increase the risk of virologic failure, which we know is very low. It's only 1% when you aggregate all the studies, very low risk of virologic failure. But in that light, we know that patients who have, if you have two or more of the baseline risk factors, A1 genotype, A1, A6, presence of BMI greater than 30, and presence of RAMPs, resistance against ropivirine, those, if you have two or more of those things, your risk is higher. So just be mindful. If I had a patient who had two or more of those risk factors, I certainly would not use the regimen. The challenge is that we often don't have the third part, which is the resistant, the RAM against ropivirine is something that we don't routinely check for. And so we have to continue to be our clinicians. And remember that in this patient that was just presented, that patient had only one of those three traditional baseline risk factors for resistance. And I personally would not be trying to force this regimen or any other regimen on patients. We should personalize patient therapies, and there are many patients who will be eligible based on their known history and lack of resistance and long-term suppression.
Well, thank you very much to Dr. Taiwo, and thank you to our listeners for joining in. As a reminder, to view the full IAS 2021 conference coverage program on the Clinical Care Options website, click on the link in the show notes for this episode. And please be sure to check back regularly for more episodes on important infectious disease topics. Thank you, and have a wonderful day.